Welcome to the InSource podcast. My name is Tracy Melissa Wheaton, and I'm the technology specialist at InSource. Today's topic is civil rights and the special education law, how the zeitgeist of the civil rights movement of the 1960s helped propel disability rights to the fore. Our guest today is Dr. Sina Skelton, who's the project director at the Great Lakes Equity Center. As project director, she works in collaboration with the center's principal investigators to plan, direct, and manage projects and services offered to the state and local education agencies throughout the center's six-state region. Dr. Skelton has worked as an educational consultant for a regional special education resource center in Southwest Ohio, a lead consultant for three statewide school improvement initiatives funded by the Ohio Department of Education, and as co-director of a professional learning and technical assistance at the Equity Alliance at Arizona State University, and assistant director of professional learning and technical assistance at the Great Lakes Equity Center at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. She has garnered more than 15 years of experience working in the areas of systems change, school improvement, and educational equity. Dr. Skelton has been an adjunct professor at Northern Kentucky University, the University of Cincinnati, and the College of Mount St. Joseph. She has co-authored book chapters on implementing systemic change for improved student outcomes and regularly presents at numerous local, state, and national conferences on various topics related to promoting the achievement of diverse populations. And with that, Dr. Skelton, welcome.
Thank you, Tracy. Very happy to be on this podcast.
It's a pleasure to have you with us today. Before we begin with the questions, I wanted to give a little introduction into the topic of our conversation today. When we think about special education and disability rights, we don't necessarily think about the African-American civil rights movement of the 1960s, but I think it's important to note that the families of children with disabilities owe a great deal of gratitude to the civil rights movement of the 1960s, because without the zeitgeist created by the civil rights movement at that time, I feel it's doubtful that disability rights issues would have gotten the kind of traction they needed to move forward, both in terms of the public consciousness and also in terms of legislation. I just wonder, what are your thoughts on that, Dr. Skelton?
Well, Tracy, I mean, you're exactly right. The disability rights movement shared many similarities with the civil rights movement, particularly beginning in the 1960s and even prior to then. And basically, it's that similar struggle. In our country for various groups, including African Americans and other people of color, other racial minorities, who've struggled historically to gain full citizenship and who have been denied equality and full access to society. It's very similar to the struggles that many people with disabilities have experienced over many, many generations in this country. And so learning from the actions taken by African Americans and other civil rights leaders in that movement, particularly during the 1960s, members of the disability community were motivated really by those struggles to both organize themselves as a sort of unit, organize themselves as a community to confront these issues. And so both groups have really confronted and continue to confront negative stereotype, bigotry, and continue to strive for equality, inclusion in public affairs and decision-making and policy. And really, throughout history, the right to really be a full member of society. Individual disabilities have come together. They've organized themselves. They fought against prejudice, discrimination, using some of the same strategies that African-Americans used during the civil rights era. Such as acts of civil disobedience, boycotts, blocking traffic, protest sit-ins, all of those kinds of strategies that we see so often and we've seen on television and during documentaries that were a part of the civil rights movement. The disabilities community has also used those strategies and have been shaped and learned from those experiences. And so really, it's really the civil rights movement of the 60s has been the force of change to raise public awareness of the struggles and of the quest for full equality in society by people with disabilities.
You know, that's so interesting to me. And I wondered, as you were talking there, I was wondering, did civil rights leaders, like, for example, Dr. Martin Luther King, might he have at any point, you know, sat down and talked with people in the disabilities rights arena about, you know, how they might, you know, more effectively get their needs met?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I don't know that specifically the answer to that, but my thoughts are the civil rights movement was predicated on the rights of all people, regardless of characteristic, to really be judged by the character, the content of their character, and to really and to have every access to the rights, privileges that our Constitution provides us all as citizens of this country. And I believe that Martin Luther King, if he had sat down with various people leading the disability community, would have supported their efforts, would have given guidance, and would have joined their efforts in towards fights for equality. So I'm not sure if those conversations occurred, but I know within the parameters of what the civil rights movement was all about, you know, the civil rights movement was not just about equal rights for Black Americans. It was about equal rights for everyone, including women, and I would also people with disabilities.
I would envision the same thing myself. You know, I think there's plenty of room at that table for everyone.
Absolutely.
People realize just how bad things were for children prior to this legislation being passed. And the history of children with disabilities in America is especially bleak. Can you describe for our listeners what the typical life for a child with disabilities might have been like during colonial America, the Victorian era, or like the mid-20th century? I know it was probably quite different in all of those. I think the one thing they may have all had in common is marginalization of individuals with disabilities. But maybe take us through historically some of these time periods and what a child with a disability might have experienced.
Sure, certainly. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I was, you do a little research and reading about the different experiences of people with disabilities and children with disabilities specifically over the course of our historical timeline in our country. It's interesting how people are treated differently in accordance to sort of what the economic trends are in the country. If we think back to the colonial days, you know, medical care was practically non-existent. Disease was, you know, very prevalent, and many living conditions were substandard. People lived, you know, the rural culture was very, very much the economic force at that time. People lived really spread apart from each other. And so disability occurred at a high rate, but there was sort of this different perspective on it. While in colonial America, in some of our larger cities, people with disabilities were shunned, particularly people with significant physical differences or mental differences. But there is some evidence that for those who had disabilities that were a little less involved, if you will, a little less severe, that they were more accepted in the community, more accepted, particularly in this country, where you think about, you know, the colonial America versus some of the European cities. You know, accidents occurred. Of course, there were illnesses that rendered many people disabled at various different times in their lives. And so the majority of the sort of everyday folk, if you will, sort of made adaptations, and they accommodated for people with different characteristics, the people with different abilities, and these people lived within their community. And even if you look at some of our more renowned citizens of colonial America, you can see where, for instance, Thomas Jefferson, Washington Irving, you know, they had speech difficulties. We had renowned artists such as John Brewster Jr., who was deaf. William Prescott had a visual impairment. Even Stephen Hopkins, who signed the Declaration of Independence, he himself had cerebral palsy. And so you had at that time this sort of continuum, if you will, of responses and reactions to people with disabilities. People who had very, very severe or what we might call today low incident kinds of disabilities, very involved disabilities, were unfortunately shunned and by the community. People who had more sort of less sort of severe kinds of disabilities were accepted in their community. People who became disabled because of accidents, adaptations were made. And it wasn't until we began to see a shift in sort of our economic force that you begin to see the shift in perception about people with disabilities.
That's fascinating. Two questions arise. When you say shunned, what does that mean? Like basically turned out to try and make it for themselves, or just not allowed to come to church or go to community gatherings?
Sure. Yeah, that's a good, great question. And I think it was a variety of those actions. Oftentimes, people with more involved disabilities were frequently segregated and put in institutions or asylums even at that time, or kind of hidden away at home, you know, hidden behind closed doors, just kept within the family and not really out in the community.
Okay. And thank you for answering that. And I'm really interested in what you said about how things for individuals with disabilities began to change as societal economics began to change. Can you kind of expand on that a little bit?
Sure. As our sort of economic culture changed from, or economic system or force changed from a more agricultural base to a more sort of industrial base, then people with disabilities, the perception was that people with disabilities could not really contribute to society, could not really contribute to the economic base of society. And this is where you began to see a real sort of negative attitude about the worthiness, if you will, of people with disabilities. And so it became more of a, you know, these people are not going to contribute to the community economically, so therefore they are either to be pitied or seen as sort of tragic because they're unfit or unable to contribute to society, or you know, people to really sort of, again, be shunned, be kept at home, be treated almost as children for their entire lives, as if children with disabilities don't grow up to be adults. You know, this sort of keeping people at sort of this childlike existence.
Interesting. And so the idea then, if you can't contribute in a meaningful way to the greater economic good, you know, the definition by which was established by the captains of industry, I'm sure, then that was pretty much it. I mean, and so people with disabilities were then kind of reduced to the lowest common denominator, human, but not yet, not quite full under the law in some way.
Absolutely. You begin to see this, you know, shift through in turn during the Victorian era, where again, people with disabilities were not seen really as employable. And at this time, of course, you know, everyone really had to make a living. And you begin to see, in order to make a living, many people with disabilities served as really sort of objects of entertainment. And so you begin to see circuses and expeditions or exhibits, if you will, featuring, and I hate to say that, but really that was sort of the thinking of the time, featuring people with differences, featuring people with disabilities as sort of entertainment and circus you know, exhibits and features and in fact, those were the places where people with significant disabilities were able to really make a living. So on one hand, you have this sort of tension of this being marginalized and being seen as an other, being othered and being seen as less than human and as some type of focus of ridicule and at the same time, people being forced in those positions in order to make a living. And in those positions, they were able to take care of themselves financially, able to stay out of some of the workhouses and what they call elm houses at the time, where people who were not employed and who were homeless were sort of kept and housed. And so, and again, that parallels, Tracy, with some of the struggles with people of color, particularly African Americans and other racial minorities in this country, being sort of forced to take on jobs, if you will, that were demeaning and yet provided economic freedom on the other hand. And so you have that same parallel experience with people with disabilities, where the jobs were demeaning but yet also provided economic independence.
Wow. Now, what a conundrum. I mean, on the one hand, you continue to perpetuate the stereotype that you're, you know, that you are different, that otherness stereotype.
Yes.
But that very otherness is what it is that makes you employable. And so you got this horrible kind of dynamic going on where you're constantly being forced to choose between survival and your wholeness. It's what an awful dilemma. Thank you for that explanation. That was really fantastic. Now, I know things like started to change for folks with disabilities around the mid 20th century. And I know that Brown versus the Board of Education was an important decision for the African American civil rights movement. Can you talk a little bit about that decision and what it meant not only for African Americans, but for children with disabilities as well? How did that shape the discussion of disability and the rights of individuals with disabilities moving forward?
You know, Brown versus Board is just, it's that seminal, groundbreaking court decision that really dismantled or began really the significant dismantling of segregation in our country. And specifically starting with schools, that we all know that famous sort of quote that comes out of that decision, that separate is not equal. And what that did for us as a country, what that did for people of color, specifically African Americans, but other people of racial minorities as well, and then how that influenced how we began to think about educating children, was to look at the educational experiences in terms of outcomes and also in terms of the quality of the experience that children were having. And so what Brown did was say, you know, the fact that African-American children, Black children, had schools and sometimes books was not really enough. When you begin to think about the quality of the experience and when you think about the impact of having children separated based on something as that really has no bearing on education, and that's the color of a person's skin, then you set up what we see, and what we saw then were disparities in student outcomes. And it was that same sort of thinking that helped really to look at integration, not just in terms of students of color, but also in terms of students with disabilities. At that time, or before that, there was this separating children of disabilities in different facilities and different educational facilities and buildings, if you were educating children at all, disabilities. And so what the passage of IDEA, of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act in 1975, that act was designed to enhance the attainment of equal access for all children, specifically for children with disabilities. So as Brown versus Board of Education was designed, and that case was basically predicated on equal educational opportunities, specifically of African-American children, you have the same premise, if you will, for the groundbreaking public law 94-142, which was the precursor to the IDEA, which is what we know the law to be called today. The tension, though, that we see with those two, with the IDEA, the two, I want to say, sort of critical or pivotal ideas, ideals of IDEA, if you will, it's sort of this tension between not having. It's a situation between integration, right, which comes from the Brown versus Board, this whole notion that separate is not equal, and at the same time, providing individualized educational services. So how do you individualize without separating? Or can you individualize and not separate? So those are sort of the two tensions that really the IDEA sort of holds. And it leads educators and families to consider then the least restrictive environment. This is how IDEA tried to sort of handle these two, I don't want to say opposing, but two certainly complex ideas, right? IDEA tries to sort of address that by this mandate of least restrictive environment for providing free and appropriate public education, also known as FAPE. So while we're not to automatically assume that children with disabilities need to be in separate educational experiences, classrooms, schools, so on and so forth, at the same time, there's this focus on making sure that the education that they receive, that children receive, is individualized to their specific needs. And so in order to address that, then educators and family members are called to think about and consider the least restrictive environment for providing free and appropriate public education.
When you mentioned that, when you talked about the tension, right, the sort of, double-edged sword. On the one hand, you know, there is this this piece which says, you know, all children with disabilities are guaranteed certain rights, which sort of, that's wonderful. That's exactly what we want. But then on the other hand, to the extent that they are guaranteed those rights, also sort of singles them out as different, as other, and so that we have to be very guarded in the way we exercise, you know, what constitutes the best possible, education given their needs. And so being very, very careful to always do things in the least restrictive manner, to me, I mean, I think that is sort of the essence of it. But that sort of dualism reminds me a lot of what we were talking about how individuals with disabilities were often forced to do work that they didn't want to do, which reinforced the stereotype of otherness, while still it was the thing that made them so much like other people in that they were able to earn money.
Yes.
And I think about that too when I think about supported employment, for example. People with disabilities have many, many talents and can work in a wide variety of fields beyond, say, food and filth, for example.
Absolutely.
And, but then again, the way we make inroads for people with disabilities is often as professionals in the field is often to point out that they are in fact unique, but, you know, they can do these things. There does seem to be this sort of tension that I don't know. Is that true also in the African-American experience?
Absolutely. Yes, it is. Absolutely. And it's interesting, speaking as an African-American woman with a disability and has had a disability all my life I've experienced, and it's funny when I tell my own personal story that I've gone through sort of the history of education. I sort of lived through the history of special education. Yeah, I entered school, kindergarten in 1975. And so I entered school right when IDEA became the law of the land, and have experienced being educated in a separate facility altogether from typical developing students to attending the same school building, if you will, a schoolhouse, as typical developing children, but in self-contained classrooms for all major content subject areas, to being mainstream for important classes like wood shop and metal shop and the gym and lunch, to experiencing, you know, various degrees of inclusion or inclusive practices in terms of actually, you know, being in class with typical developing peers, and to then going, of course, off to undergraduate school and then graduate school just completely with, you know, everybody else and completely part of the mainstream, if you will. So it's interesting when I look back at my own personal experience. But back to your question in terms of this sort of duality in terms of it's being an individual yet also being a part of a particular community of individuals that has been historically marginalized and disenfranchised, and that you do struggle with that, you know, I'm Sina and all the characteristics that make Sina Sina. At the same time, I am Black, and I am a woman, and I am a person with a disability, and so all of those societal structures and policies and perceptions, beliefs that are sort of applied to a group of people because of the particular characteristic that makes that group sort of a group, dealing with that as well. And it's an interesting sort of identity process, Tracy, if you will, for individual. And of course, all people with disabilities have, of course, other characteristics as well. So, you know, there are women, obviously, with disabilities, and so you have the identity of the of being a woman and dealing with the gender bias that's out there that we know, as well as the disability bias. If you are a person of color, then you have sort of the trifecta, if you will, dealing with, you know, different beliefs and policies and practices that are oftentimes barriers to equal access to you know, just to many things. It is something that I think people of color experience as well as people with disabilities. And most often, people with disabilities are, you know, people of color as well as gender bias. And now we're beginning to see a gender bias, not just gender bias against, particularly in our schools, that marginalizes girls in certain areas, but we're also seeing some gender bias that marginalizes our boys in other ways. So we have a lot of work to do in this country in terms of inequality.
We sure do. And I cannot thank you enough for that very personal sort of reflection on your own life and your own circumstances and sort of growing up as IDEA was growing up and you growing up right along with it. And I appreciate that, as I'm sure our listeners will as well. In your estimation, I mean, and you're a very good person to speak on this growing up, having grown up with IDEA, how do you feel, how far do you think we've come? I mean, you referenced just a moment ago that we've got a long ways to go. I agree completely. I could not agree with you more. We do have a long way to go. But do you feel that what we've accomplished, is it significant? I mean, are things better now than they were, for example, when you first started going to school?
Absolutely they are. In many ways they are. You know, when you think about really the pathway towards and for me, the sort of vision, if you will, is a safe and inclusive community for all people. And, you know, beginning with and because I'm an educator, beginning with, you know, ensuring that we have safe and inclusive and responsive schools for all of our students, regardless of their characteristics. I mean, in essence, because of the diversity of characteristics of our children that are in our school. And when we have seen a pathway, a journey, if you will, from students, children with disabilities being absolutely excluded from school altogether. I think back in prior to 94-142 or the Education of Our Handicapped Children Act, which was the previous name for the special education law that we have today, IDEA, I think only 1 in 7 or 1 in 5 students with disabilities were even actually educated in schools. And so we've certainly come a long way in terms of access, in terms of talking about, thinking about, struggling over, trying to work through how we can best educate all of our children, including our children with disabilities and our children with the wide variety of disabilities that they have and that they come to us with in our schools. Starting with exclusion, moving towards, those children being educated but yet in segregated facilities, but moving from segregated facilities and classrooms for the most part to children into a vision of integration, of inclusive practices for all of our students. And then moving from that, from the idea of integration to really inclusiveness. And I think we are moving on that trajectory. And I think that, with every reauthorization of IDEA, we see more and more language that moves us towards that trajectory. So absolutely, I think things are better. But some of the challenges that we still have and that we see, we're dealing with achievement gaps. And so while there may not be gaps in terms of access, there are certainly gaps in terms of students fully participating to the extent that they can make progress and significant progress in the general curriculum. We're also struggling with the rigor and the quality of general education, in that matter. And so when you talk about then designing specially or developing specially designed instruction to help students who may need assistance to not only access but make progress in, we want to make sure that children are accessing and making progress in high-quality education. And so we're still struggling with what high-quality education looks like for all students and ensuring all students have access to it. We're still struggling with how do we close not just the achievement gaps by raising the achievement of our students with disabilities, not by lowering standards, not by lowering expectations, but also we're struggling with those opportunity gaps. So how are we ensuring that students with disabilities are given the opportunity to participate in different course levels and college preparatory courses or career readiness kinds of experiences that are truly reflective of their potential and not sort of limited by sometimes adults' perceptions of what a student can and cannot do. Yeah, we're still dealing with that. We're still dealing with family alienation and how responsive our schools are in supporting our parents and our families of children with disabilities. Understanding the complexity of the family dynamics and being supportive of families and parents and working with the schools in collaboration, not just around IEP meetings or the evaluation process, but also around the actual instruction of children in everyday experiences. And that homeschool communication, homeschool collaboration, as I know you know, Tracy, is so important, and we're still struggling with that. We're still looking at and struggling with issues around disproportionality and the overrepresentation of, particularly of African American boys in special education programming. And the concern around that is multifold, but one, or multifaceted. One is, are we appropriately identifying young people? And then, so that's one issue. The second issue is that for children for whom special education is an appropriate service for, are those services of high enough quality to ensure that they have positive outcomes after they leave, you know, post-secondary outcomes? We know through data that we have a lot of work to do in terms of how well we're preparing children and students with disabilities to be to be adults with disabilities who are contributing and able to take care of themselves, able to engage in college and career, those kinds of things. We have work to do in that area. And we have a lot of work to do in terms of our own expectations as educators for students, for diverse students in general, and more specifically for students with disabilities. And the last thing, Trace, I would say in terms of some of the challenges that we're still working through is this ideal of ableism. And I want to preface this by saying sort of my personal thoughts about what disability is and what it is. For me, and for many others, but for me, disability is just a normal part of human variation, that we all come to this particular human experience with differences, with unique characteristics, with and that disability is no different from the differences that we have in skin color or hair texture or,
I love it. I love it. I love that we're gifted on a continuum.
On a continuum, absolutely. And we're disability is a part of the normal human experience. And all of us or any of us at any time may acquire a disability at any time, may have been born with a disability. And really that term disability, understanding that in and of itself is a social construct. And it is a very fluid idea. And it's interesting, when I started my career in Cincinnati, I was a school psychologist in the Cincinnati area in Ohio. And at the time when I first started my career, the requirements, if you will, or the definition of a child with, at the time, the label, if you will, was mental retardation. So for a child to be identified as a student with mental retardation, and in order to then get special education services as a student with mental retardation or developmental delays, you know, there were two primary areas that were looked at. One was intellectual or cognitive ability based on IQ scores, and one, of course, was the adaptive behavior skills. And when I was starting out in my career, the IQ cutoff, if you will, was 60 IQ. When I was just across the Ohio River in Kentucky, the IQ cutoff was 70. So you can literally become mentally retarded just by driving across the Ohio River. And that's just how, you know, almost ridiculous, you know, this socialness is, you know, that it's so arbitrary. And disability is a testament to the extent to which the societal's perceptions and values and structures and policies are flexible and to be responsive to difference as opposed to anything else. And so we think about that in terms of ableism. Ableism is this thinking that we have to do things the same or approximate sort of the typical, and I'm using able, I'm putting abled body in quote, air quotes, way of doing things as if that is the only and best way of doing things. And the focus of any sort of disability support is to move people with disabilities closer to the quote-unquote normal. And when you think about it that way, I mean, that in and of itself, you know, shows inherent bigotry. And we all do things differently. So whether I read using my fingers and using Braille versus taking in information, listening to an audiobook, that, you know, literacy is literacy. And so Braille, if I'm blind and my form of literacy, of print literacy, is Braille, then that should be totally appropriate and totally what we support youngsters in learning to be literate in that language, in their language. Same thing with American Sign Language for people who are deaf. But there's this push almost in terms of that we talk about as ableism, to push disabled people to function just like or as closely to abled people as possible. And so, you know.
That is so interesting, and I really appreciate, you know, and language is so powerful. I mean, we speak about disability, and, you know, as if to imply that people cannot do, are not able, are in some way not able to do something. And I was struck by what you said about, well, it's not a question of not being able to. It's a question about how to do it my way, their way, you know, this person's way. You know, we are all born on sort of this continuum where we have different strengths and talents. And, you know, I like the idea of being differently abled. I like that language as opposed to disability. And I, to me, you know, language is very powerful, you know, and if we can get our minds around using terms like differently abled, you know, or, you know, speaks a different language, for example, or reads differently. I mean, it really does a better job of describing, first of all, what the concern is. But it also, I mean, it sort of normalizes all of us, doesn't it? I mean, it sort of takes the pressure off.
Absolutely. You know, you're so right. Language is so important. And we struggle. We struggle with it. We struggle. I think any time, and I don't have the answer, Tracy, but.
Darn it.
Any time we get into label, we get into trouble. And I think that's sort of where we are. When we attempt to label people, we struggle with that and we get into trouble because not one label does not reflect, you know, a total person. It doesn't tell you anything about a person. And it reflects more, I think, sort of society's ability to be responsive to difference, to A, appreciate difference, to value and celebrate difference, and also to be responsive to difference. And I think that's something that we all continue to struggle with. I know that, you know, and there's, you know, this sort of, and I don't know if there's a need to label, but I know we do that. We do that in order to, for efficiency's sake, right? Talk about things in an efficient manner and for groups or whatever. And it's that struggle between, you know, not letting the label define who you are, if, you know, and or not letting the label cloud how we understand each other.
Yes, that's beautifully, beautifully put, and I could not agree with you more. Thank you, Dr. Skelton, so much for your time. I've just so enjoyed having this discussion with you today, and I would love to have you back on the show. Are you game?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Anytime.
Fabulous. Well, I can't thank you enough for your time. It's been wonderful, and wish you all the best moving forward, and do stay in touch with us.
They will do, Trish. Thank you so much for reaching out to me. I really enjoyed this, and we look forward at the Great Lakes Equity Center look forward to working with you guys and any other kind of collaborative opportunity. So again, thank you. Thank you to your listeners. I hope you all enjoy this podcast, and I look forward to listening to it myself, which is saying a lot because I really don't like to hear my own voice.
Well, I think you'll enjoy this. You did a fantastic job, and once again, we're very grateful to have had you on the show. We really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the InSource Podcast. All the opinions discussed in this podcast are the opinions of the guests and not necessarily the opinions of InSource.